Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Wildland fire contractors, caterers, and support crews, you're in a specialty business and you need to work with someone who understands your business. Bancor Insurance is a specialty insurance agency and we specialize in insuring wildland fire contractors, caterers, and support crews. Don't take my word for it. Go to our website at www.wildlandfirecontractor.com and hear what our customers have to say. You could save as much as 37% off the cost of your insurance today. Call Rex at 800-452-6826.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. This is Peter Matthews, and we're here at Firehouse World with a panel on wildland firefighting. And today we have Brian Crandall, John Culbertson, and J.P. Harris. I'd like to thank the three panelists for joining us today. Brian, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background with the fire service?
Peter, it's great to be here with Firehouse Radio. Thanks for that opportunity. Peter, I've been in the fire service for 33 years, full-time and volunteer. I serve in Montana in Gallatin County, which is south-central Montana, just north of Yellowstone National Park. Serve with the Central Valley Fire District, City of Belgrade Fire Department, right on Interstate 90. We live in an area that has an extensive amount of interface, both a kind of a grass and sagebrush interface, as well as a strong interface that's kind of in the trees. And so we've been active in working with John Harrison, our friends at the Los Angeles County Fire Department, for about 20 years is the way it's coming up. And so that's a little bit about who I am. Thanks for letting me come.
Thank you. John Culbertson, a little background on yourself, please.
Peter, thanks for giving me the opportunity to be on the panel today. I've been in the fire service for about 12 years, all in Montana, as volunteer and paid. Currently a training officer with Central Valley. It's the same fire department that Brian Crandall works with. And I have some background in hazardous materials and as well as training. I work for the State Fire Training School also. And I've had the opportunity to work with John and listen to his material on wildland interface firefighting and strategies for about 8 years now. JP's come to Montana many times and had a great time, learned a lot from him, and that's my story.
Okay, and J.P. Harris.
Yes, John, J.P. Harris. Thank you, Peter, for having us, and hello to everybody back east that's probably going to be listening to this or may be listening to it. I spent 38 years with the Los Angeles County Fire Department. I retired in 01, retired as a battalion chief, 22 years as a captain. Since I've retired, I've doing an awful lot of training, 50, 60 days a year, go all over the western United States. During my period with LA County, I specialized in wildland fires, in particular wildland urban interface fires. And during the course of this time, I've been involved in 7 investigations where either firefighters been burned or burned fatally, and or equipment have been burned or improper firing operations. So there's a real need out there for what I call the lay firefighters. Most firefighters in the United States, other than the federal agencies such as the Forest Service, BLM, BIA, etc. Our main business is EMS, structure fires, and then occasionally we go to wildland fires. And there's a real need out there to share with firefighters a way to safely protect structures on these wildland urban interface fires.
Okay.
I kind of went into where I wasn't supposed to. I was supposed to just introduce, but that's what I did.
Well, I can lead in from there. Okay, so looking at that, JP and everyone else here, what are some of the current tactics that are being employed by the Forest Service during the wildland, wild urban interface operations that have been successful? What are some of the ways that the Forest Service should be looking to employ safe operations?
1996, we had an incident in Malibu where we burned several firefighters, two from the city of Glendale Fire Department and two from the Los Angeles City Fire Department. And I happen to be the lead investigator on that incident. And what we came up with after that was changing our guidelines. Prior to that, we were going by different guidelines which are produced by the federal government agencies, and some of them are a little bit counterproductive when we're doing structure protection. So a fellow by the name of Paul Gleason, Forest Service hotshot superintendent, came up and looked at our rules of engagement. And there's quite a few of them. There's 50-some rules of engagement for wildland firefighting. And Paul got out of those, took out of those the three most important, and he created what's known as LCES, the acronym LCES. And that stands for absolute minimum safety on a wildland fire is, first of all, to have a safety zone, have an escape route if you're away from the safety zone, and then have a lookout for your people, and then have communications with your men, your boss, and adjoining forces. So we took that a step further and incorporated it into structure protection in the wildland-urban interface. And what we came up with after Malibu and the Calabasas incident was we don't want to commit to a structure fire unless we have a safety zone for our apparatus and our people. And you'll notice that I put apparatus ahead of the people, ahead of the firefighters, because it takes a bigger area to protect that fire apparatus than it does the firefighter. So if we have a safety zone for the apparatus, say out in the street or at the end of a cul-de-sac, or in front of the house or hiding behind the house, using the house as a barrier, then it stands to reason that the firefighters would also be safe at that apparatus. And so that's what we've been teaching. Now, I need to define what I mean by a safety zone for the apparatus. What I'm saying is that you're not going to bring that rig, whether it's a Type 3 rig or a 6 or a Type 1 or a water tender, you're not going to bring that back to your home department with any damage on it, such as crack windshield, drooping tail lights, any damage to it, change the color of the paint on it, etc. In other words, that apparatus, wherever you park it and you say that's in a safety zone, it's not going to be hurt. It's very similar to what we define as a safety zone for a firefighter. And basically, that is reducing it, is a firefighter will be safe in an area without deploying his fire shelter. So that's what we've been teaching. And the end result is we're only going to commit to a structure if we have a safety zone. If we don't have a safety zone, we're not going to be there, and we have some options for that, which we can discuss in a minute. But when the fire comes, we're not going to leave that safety zone. We're not going to start driving around in zero visibility and then become victims of whatever Mother Nature throws at us. We've decided we're safe there. No matter how smoky it gets or big globs of fire blowing around, we're okay at that apparatus. We're going to stay there till the fire passes.
You know, John, in watching that work in the street, what it's really done for us and being a student of your good work and you coming up and helping us learn up there and paying attention to our experiences, we've been able to connect how to keep our guys safe as our top priority, take care of Mrs. Smith's home or other valuable property, and do that in a way that's extremely efficient for us. And so what it's done for us is really change the way we look at our interface today, whether it's grass or a grass brush mix or tall trees, is we're now looking at safety zones. And Peter, really what that's done for us is bring us kind of a functional behavioral routine on the incident scene. It says the first thing we do before the incident, way before the incident, our everyday familiarization with our first due area is we're now looking in terms of safety zones. That's a huge piece for us. And when we talk to our residents out there now about what they can do to live safely in the interface, which you can live safely in the interface, as John was saying, if you prepare years ahead for a fire, the buildings will be safer, the people can ride out the fires in those buildings, and the firefighters can stay there and help when they need to. So it's really added a lot of focus for us. And the best part about what John's done is that it gives firefighters on the ground, on the engine company, something, a clear direction of what they should be doing before incidents and during the incidents in a way that helps keep them safe. You know, we've really, John has created kind of an important link between what Alan Brunicini talks about in his risk management discussions about firefighters risking their lives a lot in a highly calculated manner to protect a savable life. We're risking our lives a little to, again, in a highly calculated manner to protect savable property. And what John's done is give us the tools for that. If you have a safety zone at a home or a piece of property that you're trying to protect, firefighters can stay there. In fact, if they have enough of a safety zone, we can put it on what John calls a patrol status, where you now have one engine that's patrolling four or five homes where the occupants can actually stay and stay safely. So this has been really defining for us over the last 20 or 30 years in the wild land industry to be able to be a real value add on a response now, where in the past, because we didn't know, we might have been further back and not as effective because we weren't as close. And now we've learned how to be close and be safe doing that.
And the fact is it works. And I agree with what Brian said, and JP knows that what JP has been coming, at least to Montana, and teaching us about having a safety zone for the apparatus, I personally have used it firsthand, and other fire departments in Montana have been doing this, and it works, and the firefighters feel comfortable with it because they now have an understanding of what it takes to be safe, and they can go into these areas, look for the correct indicators that dictate that is in fact a safety zone. The fire truck can stay there. They can stay and defend a home, or not stay there and get in trouble. So it's been very effective for us in Montana.
Okay, and going to that, structure protection is another big catchphrase in the fire service right now. What are your thoughts on the current practices with structure protection? When is it right to do it? When is it not right to do it? When is it time to leave?
Very good, Peter, and thanks for leading me right there. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, we've come up with four categories of types of structures. and we like to think that our description, our category, tells you, gives the firefighter an action to take. It self-describes. So using LCES as the basis and the safety zone for the apparatus is the most important, is we either have a safety zone or we don't have a safety zone. But it's not that simple, because we have to have a couple different categories. I'd first like to deal with, you pull up, firefighters, we have to realize that many homeowners do not have their house to where it's defendable. And those, we got to learn to not accept that assignment. Just like we would not, as a municipal or a rural fire department or a volunteer fire department, we would never get on a roof that we knew to ventilate it if we knew it was too late to be on that roof. So likewise, on a wildland fire, if it's unsafe to protect a structure, you don't have the necessary defensible space to create that safety zone for the apparatus and the people, then you don't need to be there. So let's say that there's no safety zone for your apparatus. Now, we'd like to say, in the old days, there was terms used, at least in the western United States. We might call those homes losers or write-offs or urban renewal. And the reason firefighters come up with that was because our guidelines in our books were not clear. They really didn't create a category. They had a description of a category. So for no safety zone available, we've come up with two categories. The first one is, if there's time available, to prep the house. Perhaps we're going to use foam. We might do some light mitigation like move lawn furniture, etc. Perhaps put foam on a wood pile. I personally don't feel we should move the homeowner's wood pile. The homeowner knows the rules, and if he doesn't take care, we don't have to do that. So we're going to call that prep and go. The key being that you have to have time to go to a safety zone after you've done your preparatory work. Now there's one more. If you don't have a safety zone, now, we just don't know whether there's life threatened in that house unless we check it out. For instance, in the larger city areas, we have a lot of children who are left home alone in the early afternoon, 2:30 to 5, 6 or 7 o'clock, single family parent or perhaps both parents work. So there's literally children home every afternoon in just about any city you might go. And those children, of course, are instructed not to open the door for anyone, and we're that anyone. So we have to make sure that there's nobody left behind. So we're going to call that rescue drive-by. First, we're going to make sure they're not there, and then after that, we're going to go to a safe area. Okay? So those are the two categories where there's no LCES available. Now, let's say there is LCES available, but in many cities, here in San Diego, for instance, we don't even need to be there. The homes are built with defensible space or non-combustible roofs, non-combustible siding, very little decorative or what we call ornamental vegetation. And so we might call that standalone. Well, that's what we are calling it, is standalone. And to define standalone, we mean either patrol status, firefighter coming by every 5 or 10 minutes, or perhaps one engine or a patrol unit, type 6 rig, maybe going up and down the street every 15 minutes. Make sure that something's not starting. Or the homeowner could do it. If the homeowner's life is not threatened, he's not going to die there or get hurt, then he can take care of his own home, because most of these fires do not start with direct flame impingement. That's a major misunderstanding in the general public, and even, in fact, in the fire service. These fires are ignited by burning embers flying into the what I call stuff we have around our homes, the stuff we collect. A lot of times it might be called junk or our ornamental or decorative vegetation. That's what's catching the house on fire. And then the fourth and final category is we have a safety zone there, but the house will not survive unless it's defended by firefighters. So we have a safety zone. We've determined that. We put the rig in a safe spot. We've created a secondary water source. It might be a garden hose into the water tank. It might be a swimming pool. Or perhaps there's no external water source. So we're going to have to use what we carry in, what we bring. And then we're going to create or establish communications with adjoining forces, anybody we can see. And here's one mistake we've been making is the firefighters, when we have these incidents where we have burnovers and firefighters hurt, is they wait until they get in trouble before they establish communication with the joining forces. And we need to do that as soon as we commit. Okay, but we have to be there. We'll create a lookout. And I like to share that the primary lookout is going to be your apparatus driver, whatever you call him, the man who drives the rig to the or at least in the western United States, we'll call him an engineer. And he's going to be the primary lookout for your people. Now, you have to continually upgrade this deal. And of course, when we say LCES, we're also combining that. When we say we have a safety zone, what we've done, we've intuitively made a fire behavior prediction. How hard's the fire going to hit? And we have to take in several factors. You know, what's the fire burning now? What's the fuel bed like? What are our weather components, et cetera? Make the fire behavior prediction to determine whether we got the safety zone for our apparatus and our people.
You know, John, the part of that I think that makes the most difference on the ground is how the firefighters feel about that. If we can take that learning, look at current fire behavior, really anywhere where the fuel is similar to where you live and where you're going to respond to, you can learn a lot about what that fuel's going to do when it's burning. You learn about terrain and the role that terrain, John likes to say that tactics start with terrain and that's an important driver for that. In Montana and kind of in the Northern Rockies, the weather pit plays a great bit to do with that as well. We get a lot of wind up there, and that makes the fire do a certain set of things. And that's something worth studying and learning. And I think what that does is give us the chance when we're out in our communities every day visiting with folks in neighborhoods, it gives us the opportunity to talk about how we think that fire is going to move and how it's going to behave. It helps us really dial into weather. And in Montana, a lot of times you'll get directly opposing winds before, during, and after a weather event that goes through. Sometimes, in fact, we did a little study in our own valley, in the Gallatin Valley, on what the predictive value of the wind right now was. And so we studied 11 years of weather data, and the greatest range minute to minute in wind speed was from 0 to 46 miles an hour minute to minute. So you learn about that in terms of saying it's extremely dynamic out there. The terrain's going to have a tremendous amount to do with how that's going to go. We have probably in the in the first alarm assignment area for the Central Valley Fire District for a working event that goes on. There's probably 1,000, maybe a little bit more than 1,000 homes in that interface, and we've learned by studying it dutifully year in and year out that you can get on top of that ahead of time, and you can start to understand a little bit more about what's happening so that when there is an event, you're ready for it because you've thought about it, you've prepared for it, you've trained for it, you've built the habits that you need, and it goes like a well-oiled machine. Having the ability to apply what John talks about in the street before and during an event is what makes it so we do more than witness disasters. We're in there taking care of business, and we're very fortunate to have continue to learn with John on those matters.
Okay, John?
I think one of the beauties of JP's work for me as a training officer is it greatly simplifies what used to be a really complicated decision matrix to determine whether an engine should stay in an area or not. And John's, what I like to call the far side simplicity of this whole thing, to say either there's a safety zone or there's not. So as a training officer, it enables me to take a group of firefighters, go into our interface that Brian just referred to, and we can determine that ahead of time. Say if, and we have places that are high hazard areas, we can go there ahead of time and say, these are our safety zones. We know what the fuel is. We know what the terrain is. We know where the winds are generally going to be coming from. Now we can say, this is going to be a good spot to be when it does happen. So it's not a crisis. And whenever you start operating in that crisis mode, when people don't have that knowledge or that pre-plan in their head, that's when firefighters get hurt and the public can also get hurt.
Very good. I'd like to tail on to that pre-plan. And these guys in Montana have done an outstanding job. Now, firefighters, we pre-plan every target hazard we have. We go into them and we do we draw maps. We do all this in our, in our commercial buildings or our industrial buildings. We do this everywhere in the United States. Now, the wildland-urban interface, it's spread. It's not just in the western United States anymore. Peter, I think you were from Long Island originally. Right. Had a pretty good fire back there a few years ago. Texas, Oklahoma, the Dakotas, the Carolinas in the south. Just about everywhere in this country, we got wildland-urban interface. Now, folks, if you don't pre-plan ahead of time, I can just about... And let me first define what I mean by pre-plan. You go out into the area, and you make maps, and you break your area down into whatever you want to call them. We call them structure protection groups. In other words, what amount of firefighters can meaningfully protect a given area? And so maybe it's two or three square blocks, maybe it's a half a mile. And you have that broken down on a map ahead of time, and you have it numbered or identified by an area. And with a basic knowledge of about how many units that's going to take to protect that area. Now, if you wait and you don't do that and you don't have available maps for everyone that's going to come in, I can almost guarantee you failure. We now have Chief Tom Kuntz is going to join our program. Tom Kuntz is the fire chief from Red Lodge, Montana. And we did a drill, one of these drills up there a few years ago for, showing LCES and identifying it and actually going out into the area and making maps and doing these pre-plans types. And it wasn't but a few months after this that Chief Kuntz had a fire very close to the same area we pre-planned. And but all of his firefighters had been out there. We identified, we showed firefighters what constitutes a safe area for the apparatus and the people. And I'd like Tom to just carry right on into this and kind of tell us a little bit about how that went.
There's a good way to put me on the spot. I think one of the things just coming in here at the middle of the conversation, but the key thing about that pre-plan that helped us so much was understanding the roles and responsibilities of how people should act and what things were necessary in order to accomplish the goals. And by going through the pre-planning exercise as a group, we all had a real good and clear understanding of how we should function and how we should act. And that allowed us to be able to successfully execute the operation and be able to keep people safe, as well as to get a handle on the fire, letting us control the fire as opposed to the fire controlling us in a running and gunning interface situation.
And as I recall, that was a wind-driven fire, and numerous structures threatened, and grass and brush, and
on
a hillside, correct?
Quick-moving fire, started out, ran up a hill, got up on top of a flat area on top of a hill. Initially, we thought it ran about a mile in 15 minutes. Later, we looked at some video, and we think it took less than 1 or 2 minutes to run that mile.
Wow.
So it was a very fast-moving fire. Flame lengths off a grass and sage in the 30 to 40 foot range, visualized in pictures that we can see. So it was moving, and it ran right into about 8 homes right initially. One of them was my own. So that created an experience in itself. But it was a fast moving interface fire.
Tom, you just created a great amount of curiosity in me. Was your wife and children home at the time?
Well,
we've just talked about rescue and
children. So here's the thing that you do, and it's interesting. And I've done some programs on this interface fire, and one of the things that you see in an interface fire, especially in a place like Montana, is that in a lot of places the residents run from the fire and they evacuate. In Montana, they kind of tend to do the opposite. If they're not home and that fire starts, they are. There was a train of cars, actually in front of the fire trucks, headed into these houses, going in to get their stuff. And to the people got horses, they got animals, they got livestock. It's pretty typical that we'll see people headed towards the fire as opposed to away from the fire. So you end up with public traffic that's actually going both ways on sometimes narrow roads. And there's a fear that if they don't get home after the fire starts, that they're going to get they're going to get cut off and not be able to go back to their house. And so they tend to try and want to get home. My wife was one of those people. So my kids luckily were at daycare, but my wife was in the train with the rest of my neighbors headed to try and protect their houses.
And I think that's at least in the more rural and frontier parts of the West, that's pretty standard. And what we've tried to do is learn to embrace that in the communities and say that's part of our quality of life, actually, is that when there's trouble in Montana, people ride toward it. And so what we're trying to do is work with our neighborhoods through our community emergency response teams, our neighborhood networks, that sort of thing, where we're educating the community about saying, here is what it takes. And if you choose to stay, here's the preparation. And so really what we're saying is if you get prepared in your home, and that information, Chief Roper up in Ventura County is doing a tremendous job in this country, really bringing up the game in terms of being very graphic and descriptive about what it takes to have a home that can survive the environment it's built in, survive the interface. And what that's doing is helping the rest of the country through great leaders like Brett Waters, the fire chief that I work for and John works for, just do the kind of work that allows us to get into the communities before the emergency and say, here's what it takes. And it's, as they say, it's simple, it's just not easy. And really the change that we see in the neighborhood sometimes is 10 years to watch the folks who kind of understand it initially. And kind of neat, some of those are multi-generation families saying, okay, so if I got a little bit of material that's non-combustible within 3 feet of my house, as Dr. Jack Cohen's taught us, that's going to make a difference. And where my wood pile that John was talking about earlier is going to make a difference on the survivability of that home. And over the space of 10 or 20 years, you see where a neighbor does it, then another neighbor does it, then 3 or 4 neighbors do it. And that's extremely successful for us.
Yeah, I think one of the pieces that we focus on is creating a new image of what an ideal home looks like. You know, and in a lot of Montana, a lot of the interface, you go back 20 years, and the ideal home was covered in trees. There were pine trees coming through the deck. That was considered being a part of the woods. You were living that dream with your cabin in the woods because you were surrounded by that. And slowly over time, we're changing that image and saying, hey, this is what it looks like. This is what's comfortable is. This is what desirable is. And so we've been able to change the image of what a desirable home location or desirable community looks like through setting a standard for new development as well as educating people in older developments. And that peer pressure then creates a new image of what somebody who's buying a home wants, and that affects home values. Things that affect home values ultimately motivate people to make physical change.
And many people are truly interested in making that change. And we see that when we're out doing our pre-planning in the interface, and the neighborhoods and these subdivisions that are in the interface love seeing the fire truck in their neighborhood, and they'll come out and talk to us, and it's a great opportunity to interact with those folks and talk to them, and they want to do good, and I think it's just a great opportunity, and fire departments need to take that, to embrace that, and to get out in the interface, and while they're doing their pre-plans, interact with their customers.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Bancor Insurance and Rex LaSure have been saving wildland fire contractors, caterers, and support crews up to 37% off the cost of their insurance. Don't take our word for it. Go to our website at www.wildlandfirecontractor.com and hear what our customers have to say. Start saving money on your insurance today. Call Rex at 800-452-6826.
So going along with this, where we were trying to go is what Chief Roper is doing in Ventura County, and is becoming a hot topic all across the country, is what's been taught in parts of Australia for the last few years, and that's their deal of preparing, defending, shelter in place, or leave early. Now, I'd like to expand upon that. We all know that a couple hundred civilians just lost their lives in Australia. But the part of Australia, my understanding is the part of Australia where these lives were lost, that particular state was not participating in the prepare, defend, shelter, or leave early. So I'd just like to touch on what this means. Prepare, we're not talking about the day of the fire or the day before the fire. That has to take place at least a year ahead of time where you clear adequate clearance. What's adequate? Well, that depends on where your house is located terrain-wise. Is it on a steep slope with heavy fuel? You might need several hundred feet. If it's a level ground, you'll need considerably less. As a guideline in California, most agencies require 100 feet of clearance. L.A. County, L.A. City, we require 200 because we found out that 100 doesn't work very well in a wind-driven fire. But once you've done your preparation, you've got that good clearance, and now you're going to stay and defend. Well, what does that mean? Well, the homeowner then would stay. He'd be dressed properly, no shorts, etc. Preferably be double-layered. He'd have a ball cap on and something to protect his neck. And he's going to have his water sources. He's going to have think this thing over. And then when the big fire front comes, he's going to shelter. He's going to shelter. He's going to take shelter in the home or behind the home. Now, how long does it take to burn a home down? Most homes takes a long time to burn down. Even a wood-sided house will take considerable amount of time. Now, we've done some testing in California, Montana, where we know that the major heat wave from these brush fires goes over in just 2 or 3 minutes. And then the third component of this is, the fourth, is if you haven't done the prepare, the defending, and the shelter that ahead of time, then you need to leave early. Get your family and get out of there. And if you have no knowledge of what fire behavior is like, you probably need to protect your life. For instance, here in San Diego, we'd love to have this system because I believe the fire chief would. She's expressed that with me. But on the last big fire that went through here, they used the reverse 911. And actually, the police chief and the mayor did this without consulting with the fire incident commander. But they evacuated over about 12-hour period using the mandatory word, about 250,000 people. And then, of course, once you evacuate these people, you don't let them in for, in this case, 5 days. And so not good PR. Now, what we really need to do is create a system where those folks who are what we call mid-slope, they're on a slope, they got heavy fuel down below them, and the fire's going to come. We need to get those folks out of their homes, because if they don't go, there's a good probability they may die, especially in these wind-driven fires that we'll have here where we get the wind above 20, 30 miles an hour, and the last couple fires been 60, 70 miles an hour wind. So, but those homes that don't butt right up against the brush that are one or two deep, most of those folks are going to be just fine staying there, and the homeowner will save more homes than we'll ever be able to save. Because, well, the last fire that hit San Diego, it hit the city on a five-mile-wide front. And a city with 46 stations, and they committed 43 of the 46 engines they have to this fire. And because we're at the bottom end of the pipe here at the south end of California, the mutual aid system here just didn't have the resources to give any outside help to the city of San Diego, and they lost 400 or 500 homes in about a 20-hour period.
One thing I was going to add, John, is that I think part of that concept in Australia is also understanding when your neighbors have a safety zone. So although your house may not be savable, you know whose is, and so you know where you can go. And so if you have some homes that are less desirable to ride out a fire, you may choose to go half a block to a neighbor's house or a block to a neighbor's house that is, it does have a safety zone, as opposed to trying to stay in. And it's particularly that educational process is particularly helpful in cases where you have quick-moving fires that start and are burning in and around homes within 2 or 3 minutes of the fire start, because you don't have the evacuation time then, and oftentimes the road is the most dangerous place for those folks to be. And so if you can keep them sometimes in a safe spot, and they know where those safe spots are, you can reduce the clogging on the roadways and actually provide them a higher level of safety.
I'd like to tag on to that, and it goes back to the pre-plan of what these, like Chief Kuntz said a few minutes ago, people coming back in trying to get in, and this is why, and that's all part of your pre-plan, is establishing that contact ahead of time with your police agency, whether it's a sheriff or a local PD, and having predetermined blocking points where you can keep the residents coming back in if they're going to get hurt, and that sort of thing.
You know, John, you've been talking a lot about a recent study that the Forest Service commissioned called FACES, which I think addresses some of the lessons learned from the Cedar Fire, correct, John?
Yes,
why don't you talk about that?
Where I was trying to go there before I lost my train of thought. In the 03 fire down here in San Diego County, there was 16 fire fatalities in that fire. 15 civilians and one firefighter was burned to death. Well, most of those people, just like Chief Coons just said, a great percentage of those people died trying to escape the fire. One lady left the fire and was ordered out of her home under the threat of mandatory evacuation, and she was cut off by the fire and burned to death. And the fire did not get to her house. Her house didn't burn down. And there's several tragic deals like that. And if you'd like to read that report, it's available on the Internet. It's called FACES, F-A-C-E-S. If you type in Robert W. Mutch, it'll come up and it'll say Cedar Fire. And he's out of Missoula, Montana, and it's about an inch thick. And it's a great read. It gives a short synopsis of how each one of these people died, and there's just some tragic stories there. And so when we're using, let me just touch on that mandatory evacuation, that gets, if we don't throw it out, a lot of times the news media will add it. If we say we're recommending an area be evacuated, sometimes the news media will jump on that and say we said mandatory when we didn't. I would like to use the term voluntary evacuation, and of course that really doesn't mean anything because anybody can evacuate whenever they want. But that gets rid of mom and the kids. If they see smoke and you say voluntary evacuation, they're on the road, they're out of there, you've got them taken care of. And then I'd like us to use the term recommended or highly recommended. But the term mandatory, boy, you know, that our Constitution in the United States just gives the homeowner the right to stay and defend his home, and that needs to be honored. But what do we do in the case, like I was talking about, a mid-slope home, got heavy fuel below it, and folks are going to die if they stay in there. Then you got to do whatever you can to try to get them to leave, or at least let them know that if they stay there that they very well may lose their life. But I would like to see the incident commanders. It seems to me, what I've seen in recent, the last 10 or 15 years, the first thing the incident commander does when he gets there is throw out the word, well, we want everybody to evacuate. Well, depending on the size of your department, maybe you got 5 engines, maybe you got 10. Maybe you're like L.A. County, L.A. City. We could put 300 engines on a fire in a couple of hours. But we're still short. So, you know, if the homeowner can be, the homeowner can either be a help or he can be a hindrance. But remember, he has the right to stay and defend his home if he chooses to. So it's a tough call.
I think just, you know, in remembering that piece, and that's why with this concept, the real critical element of it is to prepare. And I think in when you look at some of the reports that have come out in the last couple of months on this leave early or stay and defend concept, that the preparedness part of it is often being missed by the media. And without preparedness and without a system, you can't have this concept. It's not something you say, oh, let's adopt this and we're going to do it tomorrow. This is a couple year adoption process, and it's an education process, and every homeowner's individual house needs to be evaluated. They need to understand their risks that they're taking, and it's not a quick fix. It's a huge preparedness model, and without the preparedness, the whole concept does not work.
I think to add to that, I think the preparedness side for the fire department. John, you had a Mark Lane, right, with the LP shots, talked about the value of maps. So if we roll the preparedness piece from the property owner into the preparedness piece for the fire department, certainly.
If you have a wildland interface area and you don't have maps printed ahead of time and available in your command vehicles, for a moment's notice, just like Chief Coon said, a fire hits, you can have a fire impact in structures within 2 or 3 minutes, 5 minutes, even if it's 30 minutes. If you don't have those maps pre-produced and available to pass out to your mutual aid companies, you are, I would say, just about doomed for failure, because without maps, like Mark Lane, a former superintendent of the Los Padres National Forest, hotshot crew, just a legend in the wildland firefighting. He said, if you don't have a map, you're going to lose. If you got maps available for all your incoming units, about 95% chance you'll run a very successful operation. So it's all part of that pre-planning, doing all those things. Your law enforcement, your preparing, defending, block parties, whatever. But here's what's got to happen, folks. Somebody's got to care. And so that's you firefighters. Now, it doesn't have to be the fire chief. It can be a battalion chief or any other chief officer. It can be a captain. But somebody's got to care enough to do, because all this stuff takes work. It takes time and it takes work. So I admire Chief Coons and these guys. Chief Crandall, in addition to his one department, he's a fire chief of a volunteer fire department. It's actually two volunteer fire departments who run together. So these guys all make sure that somebody is taking care of this. And I'm rambling on, but that's okay. So
that's okay. Well, I appreciate it. Do we have any closing comments before we finish this out?
I would like to make a closing comment. Firefighters, I'd like you to remember that a lot of times, you know, we respond to people's emergencies and we think we got to fix them. Sometimes they're non-fixable. If the homeowner has not done the preparation, done defensible, an example of this, if you're going to scratch your truck, your engine, on the way in to protect the structure, in my view, you don't need to be there. So if they haven't done that work, we didn't create the mess, we can't fix it. Let's use Chief Brunicini's deal. We'll risk a lot to save a lot, but we're not going to risk. We don't have to go in there and commit suicide to protect somebody's structure that has not done the preparatory work. We'll go in there and take reasonable risk to defend their structure, protect their home, if they've prepared it and it's defendable. But don't go in there and just commit just because you got a red truck or a yellow truck, whatever it might be, and think you got to save everything. Everything is not savable. Last year, we killed 25 firefighters on wildland fires in 2008. Now, a good percentage of those was aircraft accidents, incidents. And the second leading cause was vehicle accidents. Now, firefighters, you and I, we got total control over this one, and that's slowing down, not driving fast through heavy smoke, slowing down. If you're going through smoke and you can only see 50 feet, you got to be able to stop in 50 feet. But that one we have control over. California last year, just at the first 2 months of fire season, we had about 15 or 20 firefighters burned. Most of them were burned on their hands and their arms. Now, what's happening there? I'll tell you what's happening. We are not wearing our safety clothing when we are in the operational area. And guys, you've chosen a hazardous occupation. You have control over some of those hazards. And not wearing your gear is just totally and completely inexcusable. Now, we should all be safety officers. It doesn't take the captain to kick somebody in the butt for not wearing their safety gear. Any and every firefighter has that responsibility to be a safety officer. And if somebody's not wearing their stuff or they're wearing it inappropriately, I hate to say kick them right in the ass, but that's what sometimes we need to do, okay? And somebody will bleep that out of here. Hey, God bless all you folks out there. Work safe.
Thank you again to Brian Crandall, John Culbertson, Tom Kuntz, and J.P. Harris for joining us today on RadioFirehouse.com. And we'll put a link to the FACES report at the bottom of the podcast player page so you can download it right from there. Thank you, gentlemen.
Great job.
Thank you.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio. We'll be right back.